Well, let's talk about Madeline and Ludwig Bemelmans. This is a book that's been around now for 50 years, isn't it?
Right, yes.
Tell me how it all began with the book.
Well, the idea came. It was based on stories his mother had told him about her experience in boarding school.
Is it Madeline?
Well, that's the way it's pronounced. Madeline, yes.
Well, tell me about how Madeline began.
Well, the idea came from stories his mother had told him about her life in boarding school. And he himself had gone to boarding school. And then he said the character was based partly on his mother, partly on him, partly on me, and partly on our daughter, Barbara. The original impetus from the story came when we were staying on the Île-Dieu one summer, and he was on a bicycle bringing home some lobster, and he ran into the only automobile on the island, and his arm was badly cut. So we went to the hospital, and across the hall was a little girl who had just had her appendix out. And there was a nun there who took care of the patients. And he said she wore the kind of headdress that looked like the wings of white butterflies. Mm. And he talked to the little girl, and she showed him her scar. And he, lying in bed, looked at the ceiling, and there was a crack in the ceiling that had the habit of looking like a rabbit. And that's a famous line from the book. So then we spent time in Paris, and he did the pictures, you know, that appear in Madeline. And then when we came back to New York, we lived in Gramercy Park, and we used to go to Pete's Tavern. And on the back of a menu in Pete's Tavern, he started writing the verses. And when he took the book to a publisher who had inspired him to do his first children's book called Hansi, she thought it was too sophisticated for children. So he took it then to Simon & Schuster, who published it. And later on, Viking published the sequels and bought back the rights to the original Madeline.
So Hansi, that was published in 1934.
1939. Oh, Hansi, 1934. And then there was a book called The Golden Basket, which was published in 1936, I think it was. And then came Madeline in 1939. Oh, there was also Akito Express, I think, in, is that 1937?
That's not mentioned here.
That's not mentioned. Well, anyway, Madeline came in 1939, and she's been going ever since.
Yeah. Tell me about Madeline. What kind of child is she? Where does she live? For the grown-ups who may not know.
For the grown-ups who may not know. Well, you know, an awful lot of grown-ups know, because they have read it as children and now have bought it for their children, and even grandmothers buy it for their children. But anyway, Ludwig said that Madeline insisted on being born. And then, you know, once being born, she took on a life of her own. I think she's very courageous. She likes fun. She likes a little mischief. And she also has principles, which she stands up for. Someone said, wrote me a note, that she was the first feminist. I never thought of her that way. But she seems to be a leader. And at the same time, she's not annoying.
Now, Madeline, as the story opens in an old house in Paris that was covered with vines, led 12 little girls in two straight lines.
Now, the smallest one was Madeline.
Smallest one was Madeline. What kind of house was this she was living in?
Well, it was a kind of a boarding school, a small boarding school, only 12 little girls. And the mistress was Miss Clavel.
piece has one of the famous last lines. That's all there is. There isn't any more.
Yes.
That is a line that is in our language. Is
yes.
An expression. That's all there is. There isn't any.
Yes, I know they quoted that in his obituaries, that how many children have gone to sleep with those lines in their ears. And I thought it would sort of be a nice kind of ending to a life, to say.
Mm. Tell me about Ludwig Bimmelmans. Who was he? He was born in Austria.
Yes, it's in Meran. It's a part of Austria, a city that now belongs to Italy. It's in Tyrol, and Tyrol is a region that goes back and forth between Austria and Italy, depending on who won the last war. It now belongs to Italy, but when he was born, it was Austrian. And I guess it was the time of the Emperor Joseph.
He was born in 1898. His father was a painter.
Yes.
We're not talking about house painting.
No. No, he was an artist. Actually, he came to New York and became a jewelry designer. He worked in Maiden Lane. And, he had left home when Ludwig was six. So he and his mother went back to Regensburg, where she was born, and lived with his grandfather, who was a brewer. But then when he never did well at school. He was always a troublemaker, and he says he did, I don't know, the third grade three times. So then they did send him to boarding school, but he also failed. So then they sent him to an uncle in Tyrol who had hotel, and he worked in the hotel, and then he worked to the uncle sent him to another hotel for more experience, but he didn't do too well. He didn't get along too well with the people in charge, so they said the only thing is reform school or America.
Well, I see in the publicity material that when he was 16, he shot a head waiter.
I don't think he shot. I think that was just a story. No, he did throw a bowl of spinach at a head waiter, but I guess he thought it was more interesting to say he shot him, but I'm sure he didn't shoot.
So, but anyway, he was causing problems.
He was causing problems, yes.
So his uncle said, look, reform school?
Or America.
Or America. He wasn't sure which was worse.
Yes, yes. So anyway, when he went to take the steamer, it was from Holland. And his mother had given him money to, whatever he might need. But he did spend the money on some pistols, because he had a picture of Indians in New York. And he also thought that the elevated trains ran over the roofs of houses, up and down. And so he had this kind of romantic picture of America. So I think the captain on the ship told him the pistols wouldn't be very useful, so he exchanged them for several pairs of scissors. Anyway, he arrived, and his father was supposed to meet him, but there was some mix-up. So according to the story he told me, he spent the Christmas Eve on Ellis Island, and he was given a necktie as a present.
Wow.
And then his father came the next day and took him to where he lived. I think it was in the Bronx, but he didn't get along with his father either. So he walked out and he got a job in the Astor Hotel as a busboy. I think he said he broke too many dishes, so he had to go and get a job in the McAlpin. Eventually, he got a job in the Ritz Hotel, Ritz-Carlton, and while he was there, he joined the army at the age of 19, and was sent to, he was in Buffalo at Port Forter, and he was also in Fort Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, he wrote of those experiences in My War with the United States. Mm-hmm. Naturally, they wouldn't send him to fight Germany. So he worked in a mental hospital where these soldiers who had been shell-shocked you know, was sent. It was a terrible experience, but he didn't mind the army. He thought, he once said, the army is like a mother. Although he didn't like discipline, he didn't seem to mind the army too much. And I guess the army at that time and in that place was rather casual.
Well, you probably got used to the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
You know, instead of fighting the system, you join it and make
yes.
use of it. You know,
yes.
get easy assignments.
Yep.
And
but he said one time he was on guard duty, and someone came, general or some officer came, and he said, "Halt, who goes there?" But in with a German accent. So this general said, "My God, have the Germans gotten this far?"
Well, after that, but I imagine he was bursting out to try his artistic skills. And
yes, he always drew. He illustrated them. He kept a journal while he was there, which he sent to his mother, an illustrated journal, which she later gave back to him, and that's how this my war with the United States was done. That was the first adult book he did.
That was his first adult book?
Yes.
When did do you recall when he published that book?
I think that was 1935.
Mm-hmm.
It was right after the first children's book. It was either 1934 or 35.
He also became a restaurateur, didn't he?
Well, that's wrong in that press release. He opened the Habsburg restaurant in 1933, just at the end of Prohibition. But in the meantime, he worked at the Ritz Hotel, and at the same time, he went to art school. And in the Ritz Hotel, he got so much material, both for his drawings and his stories, by observing the customers, observing the waiters. And he did something called Life Class, which was about the hotel, but also his efforts to become an artist. And something called Hotel Splendide. There are also hotel stories. And his one ambition was to be a cartoonist, and he briefly worked for the World, the old World before it was the World Telegraph. I didn't know him at this time, but unfortunately the cartoon was not a success. It was called Count Bric-a-Brac, and this was about some crazy count living in a castle. And someone advised him that if he wants to be a cartoonist, he should have an American child, because then he could understand the American child's mind and what they would appreciate. But by that time, by the time he had an American child, he was no longer a cartoonist.
How did you meet Ludwig Bemelmans?
Well, I had been in the convent. I thought I wanted to be a nun for a while, but then I decided that was not my fate or destiny. So I came out and I went to took a business course, and it was like during the Depression, and there were not many jobs available. And besides, I saw some ad for a model from a model agency, and I thought, well, this would be more interesting than typing. So I went there, and they gave me a list of artists, and one of the ones did not really use models, but when I was there, I met Ludwig. And Ludwig was going through a terrible period of, he was living in Astoria with someone, an old houseman from the Ritz, and he used to walk across the Brooklyn Bridge to save a nickel, and not the Brooklyn, the 59th Street
mm-hmm.
Bridge. But he did eventually, he got to know people in Young and Rubicam, and he did a job for Jell-O pictures, and I guess they wrote the text, and he got all of $900, which I guess was like $10,000. So he started taking me out to dinner every night.
So you could afford it.
Yeah. Well, that eventually ran out. And when we got, it was at that, just when I met him, he was working on the Habsburg. Well, just shortly after I met him. So then when the Habsburg opened, we weren't married yet, but he lived quite well. He lived at the Habsburg and managed it in return for doing the murals. And, of course, he had all this hotel experience.
So, excuse me, he did murals at the Habsburg house as well?
Yes. That's the restaurant. Is that
in the Carlisle?
No. That was
a well-known restaurant.
Well, the Habsburg house no longer exists.
No longer, yeah.
But it did. It did exist and was very successful.
For years. I mean,
A while. I think it was about in the 50s that they closed it.
But he did murals there as well.
Yes.
I see.
Those were the first, well, not actually the first he ever did, but, I mean, he did some murals in private houses.
Now, these murals in the Habsburg house, were they preserved?
No, I don't think they were, unfortunately. Oh. But these were scenes from Austria and Tyrol, which is in all part of Austria. And they had what they called a peasant room, and they had a Schubert room with a piano painted on the wall, and that was used for private parties. And all the smart people in New York, or whatever they would have been called at that time, came. And even Mrs. Roosevelt even came at one time. Unfortunately, the head waiter didn't recognize her and wouldn't give her a table, but she was very gracious about it.
Or maybe he did recognize her and not give
her a table. Well, I don't know. That's depending on his politics, but she was very gracious about it. But anyway, Ludwig lived so well, and it was so successful, there weren't always tables for the stockholders. So they thought, this is too much, and they asked him to leave. So by that time, we had gotten married, and so we scraped enough money together. They did give him some kind of severance payment or bought back his stock. So we went on a freighter or a one-class steamer to Belgium, where he wrote and got the inspiration for the Golden Basket. That was about a restaurant in Bruges. From there, we went to Germany, and we stopped on the border to go into Austria. And one night, you know, we were there in a restaurant talking to people, and Ludwig put a cigar on his lip and gave an imitation of the Führer. So we went to Austria, but when we came back and they looked at the passports, they said, Mr. Bemelmans, would you please come this way? And they arrested him. So I ran to the American consul, and he spent the night in jail. And he was really scared, but he did say the lentil soup was very good.
In jail.
So the American consul got him out, and so he left and came back to America. He's written stories about that.
Yeah, that was no time to make fun of Hitler,
was it? No, it was not.
No.
So then we came back, and he sold a story to Hollywood and went out then to work for MGM. And the film was produced with Fred Astaire and somebody called Lucille Bremer. He wrote it with someone else, based on a story that someone else
said. Do you recall the name?
It was called Yolanda and the Thief. Mm-hmm. I think it was voted the worst picture of the year.
I don't recall that.
Do you recall it?
No, I don't.
You don't?
No.
I saw something recently. I don't know whether public broadcasting
maybe a cable, one cable or something.
There was some mention of it.
Did he like Hollywood?
Well, he made such fun of it. He wrote something called Dirty Eddie, which was a parody of Holly. It was a combination of himself and someone called Donald Ogden Stewart. And he told the pleasures, you know, of these wonderful big cigars he could afford and the restaurants he could go to. But he also told about how difficult it was to write in Hollywood. And but then he wrote this book called Dirty Eddie. And this was about a pig who was in a film. And the only thing was that the pig, I don't know, the pig got too big for the film, for the story, so they had to find another one. And there were all these pigs, and the people would say, oh, this one has real talent. And Annie, it was a terrible parody of Louis B. Mayer, called him Moses Fable, he called him. But of course, Louis B. Mayer either was told about this or recognized himself. And he said, don't ever hire that so-and-so again, unless we really need him.
He's going to keep his options open.
Yes. And then he also met a Lady Mendel, who used to be Elsie DeWolf. She was an actress, an old, old-time actress. And then she became a famous interior decorator and married someone called Sir Charles Mendel. And she and Ludwig got along famously because they both lived for the pleasures of the eye, visual pleasures, and they established a great friendship. And he called her mother, and she called him Stevie. She didn't want to call him Ludwig because the war was on at the time. He also became very friendly with Sir Charles. So he wrote something called To the One I Love the Best. As Lady Mendel had a poodle that died, and she was buried, and on the stone she put To the One I Love the Best. But Ludwig happened to visit the graveyard, and he found there were several poodles, several dogs buried, and it always said To the One I Love the Best. But it could have been at that particular time, so it might not have. Ludwig found this rather comic, but probably it was justified. It just occurred to me at the time the dog died, he probably was the one she loved the best. So Ludwig, that's why Ludwig called the book To the One I Love the Best. In it, he described a visit to the Hearst Ranch, which was very interesting. And it's quite sad in a way. He told how Mr. Hearst, with his great power, there was something inexpressibly sad about him. But he described this long dining room, and what impressed him was a bottle of ketchup on the table. And funny, my grandson, who just got a job in Los Angeles, visited the Hearst Ranch. And he said they kept it the way it was, and he said there's still a bottle of ketchup on the table. So then, after that, the war was over in 45. Mm-hmm. We stayed an extra year, and then we came back in 46. And he was able to go to Europe as a correspondent for Holiday magazine, but Barbara and I could not get passports at the time, so we stayed in the Carlisle that summer. And then he came back and did the murals, and then in 47 we went back again. And
back to Europe.
To Europe, mm-hmm. To visit Paris. Oh, we had gone in 39. I mean, that was when Barbara was a little girl, and that was when he had the accident, which inspired Madeline.
Tell me about the accident.
Well, I think I told you that he ran into the only motorized vehicle on the island, and then he went to the hospital.
That's right.
Tell
me, as he grew older, did his tempestuous temperament
mellow?
Mellow, I guess.
He was always pretty much. He didn't throw bowls of spinach or anything like that. But I know he was a member of the Players Club on Gramercy Park. You know the Players Club 15,
yes.
And he used to go over there and spend his evenings there. And then he would come home and say, I have to go back and clean out the Players Club. So I would say, well, why don't you just do that tomorrow? By that time, he'd had a lot to drink, and I'm sure he never got into any fist fights. He probably had arguments you know. But, no, he was very peaceable. It's just that he was very exuberant all the time and very restless. He, you know, always...
But I see him as enjoying the good life.
Oh, yes.
A good drink, a good cigar.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I put together an anthology, and Norman Cousins did the introduction. And he said he was the most charming man he ever met. And it's a wonderful description of him at the round table at the Algonquin, you know how he...
Was he a regular at the round table?
No, I'm sure he wasn't a regular, but he must have gone sometimes. Now, we used to go to the Algonquin for dinner or a drink, but I didn't actually realize that he did go to those luncheons, and he certainly told me a lot of things that, you know, there would be no reason not to tell me he went to the Algonquin. But obviously he did go. He was terribly restless, and he also had terrible ups and downs. You know, so exuberant, and then other times, you know, nothing. He was totally worthless. His books were no good, and then again, you know, just filled with exuberance.
Because that sounds like a typical writer.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. He was a great friend of Charles MacArthur. I don't know if you were.
Helen Hayes'
husband.
Who were some of his other friends?
I don't know that he had so very many. I mean, it's Ted Patrick, the editor of Holiday, Henry Sell. I don't know that he had that many close friends, now that I think of it.
He did a lot of work for Holiday. I remember reading pieces back in the 50s.
Oh, Holiday was just wonderful to him. He had known Ted Patrick from Young and Rubicam, from the time he did the Habsburg. And then Ted worked, he did some work during the war for, what do you call it, information, I can't think.
USIA?
Or something like that. And Ludwig briefly worked. They put out pamphlets,
right.
Briefly worked for him. So then when Ted became editor of Holiday, he asked Ludwig to work for him. And Ludwig could go anywhere he wanted, practically. And they'd say, okay, you know, if you want to do a story on Ireland, okay, if you want to do Spain. It was wonderful. But Holiday no longer exists.
No. Did you travel a lot with him?
I traveled with him, but not all the time, because Barbara, you know, was a little girl. I didn't want to drag her around all the time. We dragged her around enough, so I would very often stay when he would go off on these trips, and then I would join him at various spots, various places. Barbara did not particularly like to go to Europe. She went several times, but she didn't care about going from hotel to hotel. She had, as a teenager, she became fascinated with horses. Something which seems to happen to girls even more than boys. And I mean, the one thing was riding. We had ridden in Ecuador when she was four, and then she rode in Hollywood. But when she was in her teens, and we go back here, she got interested in showing. And I don't know whether you ever knew anybody who was horse crazy, but these people, they just live for horses and horse shows. And I often regret the first lesson she ever took, because now she has a horse farm.
Well, that's not such a bad thing.
Well, it gets in the blood, but oh, you can't believe the headaches.
Oh, I believe.
You fix the roof, and then something else leaks, and horses get sick, and especially if you care about them. There are people in the business who are really professionals, and I don't think they even like horses that much. They're interested in winning. But when you really love them, I mean, it's a great responsibility. But
Looks like a police raid.
I don't know whether...
That's a bulletin for...
Oh, is that about the hurricane?
Probably. Yeah. Let me just go back to Madeline.
Yes.
That book was published, the first...
1939.
Was it pretty well an instant success?
It was a success from the beginning. Yes, it was. It seemed to have an appeal. children liked it because I know one woman who writes about children's books, Judy Blume. She said it was the first book she ever had. Her mother got it from the library. She loved it so much, she couldn't bear the thought of returning it, and so she hid it so her mother couldn't take it back to the library. And in spite of the notices, she never said where it was, because she thought it was the only book, Madeline book, that existed. And then she said when her daughter was born, it was the first book she bought her daughter. And she spoke of other books, but she said, some books you never forget. Some characters are friends for life. So I think Madeline has become very real to children. And the verses are easy, so they can memorize them. And it's easy on the parents, because, you know, it's easy to read. But he didn't write the next book until, I think it was 1953. Was that when the Madeline's Rescue came out?
Yes, 1953.
That is very popular, too.
Well, and all there are eight Madeline books.
Six. And then the next one, Madeline's Rescue is about a dog. And the plot was, I mean, the idea was given to him by the children of Phyllis McGinley. Do you remember her? The poet she wrote for the New Yorker. She lived next to my parents in Larchmont. And the children came over one day. We were there. And Ludwig was trying to think of a plot. And he said, what should we do? And they said, well, write something about a dog, and the dog has puppies. And someone I was talking to the other day said that's one of their favorite books, Madeline's, because she has a social conscience. You know, she's, I don't know whether you know the book, but this dog is brought home, and the trustees of the school say, get it out, you know, it's a creature of uncertain race. Mm-hmm. So somebody saw in this a certain symbolism, and she did stand up to the trustees, and they kept the dog. And then, of course, the dog came around with puppies. So there were enough puppies to go all around. Each little girl had a puppy. And the next one, it was Madeline and the Bad Hat. That was written a few years later.
Yeah.
Was that 50?
That was 1957. 56. Well, did Ludwig, wherever he goes, did people say, here's the man who wrote Madeline?
Well, he was known for other things, too, because he did a lot of covers for the New Yorker.
Probably, if he were living today, he would, because the book
has been around for 50 years,
people who grew up with it.
Oh, yes, and with us, for instance, if they hear the name, people say, I know, people would say to Barbara, are you the little girl your father wrote about? Or even in this small town where Barbara lives, the people in the post office, you know, recognize the name. And Barbara gave a few talks out there to school children. Teachers asked her to do that. So he is very much identified with Madeline. Now, more with Madeline than with the other books, which are mostly out of print. Godin is bringing out something called La Bonne Table, but that is an anthology which was put together after he died.
Yeah, I know that. I have that.
But people knew him, as I say, from the New Yorker, and also from Holiday.
Here's the David Godin, La Bonne Table.
Yeah. This is all his. These are all his writings about
his
food.
His favorite subject, the art
of
eating.
Yes, right.
Let me ask you a question. Here's the 50th anniversary of Madeline, and all of us, the party
the
and
excitement,
the new
yes,
editions.
Yes.
How is this all affecting you?
Well, I mean, it's nice, and I always have tried to be anonymous because I felt I wasn't, you know, very interesting, and I didn't really deserve any reflected glory, but I seem to be getting it. And now I don't mind it so much. you know.
Well, and you're serving as his spokesman. He would be here today if he could, I'm sure.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think it's nice that people appreciate the books and that he is recognized as a classic. I think he had a feeling, he had a special feeling about the children's books. He felt children were his best, or do we have to stop? Or?
No, go ahead.
He felt children were his best audience because they're clear-eyed, have imagination and enthusiasm. And he said he himself suffered from a sort of arrested development, which maybe was not an affliction because it meant that he was constantly surprised and fascinated by everything.
Yeah,
and
well,
I noticed that you would tell him a fact that other people would, you know, nothing make anything special about. He'd say, is that true? He'd be so amazed and intrigued by it. He had that capacity for enthusiasm. He also had great respect for children and never thought you should talk down or be cute. He really worked on the pictures and the verse, you know, very, very seriously. So maybe that integrity is what comes through.
I think it does, and he sounds very much like a man I wish I had known.
Yes, I wish you did.
Well, it's really been wonderful having the chance to talk to you. I wanted to say just parenthetically that the HBO special,
yes,
Madeline, the...
Did you happen to see it?
They sent me a copy of it.
Oh, they did.
Lisa Bancroft.
Yes.
Sent me a copy of it. And I, although this is radio, I recorded the audio from it.
Oh.
So I thought I would use some of the music and so forth. When I put this together, I'll use some of the music.
Did you include the music or cut that out?
I'll use a little of the music and some of the dialogue. And
you know, that was nominated for an Emmy Award.
Right.
It didn't win, but I think that was also very nice. I was so worried about the cartoon because you know what they can do to cartoons, but they did
it
in very good. Yes, they were very faithful to the drawings, and I think it was done in very good taste. So we were very pleased about that.
Well, I'm awfully happy that you braved this weather to come in and chat with me. And unfortunately, this weather doesn't seem to be ending. I mean, you had the same problem
Thursday. I'll get home. Yes, I'll get home.
It's wonderful having the chance to meet you and have this link to Ludwig Bemelmans, because I remember him most vividly through the in the 1950s when I was a teenager in the 1950s, and I do remember the, because my parents used to subscribe to Holiday, and I do remember
those articles. And the pictures.
He used to have pictures with him, didn't he?
He also did covers for Holiday.
The covers I don't remember, but I do remember I can't remember all the specifics.
Yes.
It's been 20 years.
Well, as a teenager, you probably wouldn't pay that much attention.
Well, Mrs. Bemelmans, I thank you very, very much, and it's delightful having a chance to talk to you.
Thank you.